Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name's Claire Clark. I'm one of the hosts of the channel, and today we're talking to Rob Bodis, who is currently a senior research fellow at the Academy of Finland's Center of Excellence in the History of Experience at Tampere University. He is an internationally renowned scholar in the histories of emotions, science, and medicine. His previous books include The Science of Sympathy, Pain, A Very Short Introduction, The History of Emotions, and A History of Feelings. This is just to name a few. Today we'll be talking about his 10th book, which is titled Humane Professions, The Defense of Experimental Medicine, 1876 through 1914, which is just out from Cambridge University Press. Rob, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
I wonder if you could begin our interview by telling us just a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. I did all of my university education at the University of York in the UK, and since then had a very international career. But the book that we're talking about today is dedicated to Wolfgang Berlinger, who was my first supervisor at postgraduate level. And a profound influence on me. And he actually was he replaced John Bossi at York. And John Bossi is probably the reason that I'm an historian at all. So it was nice to honor Wolfgang by dedicating this to him.
That's wonderful. Can you tell us a little bit about, I can't believe this is your 10th book. I just can't imagine having 10 books in me. How did you come to write it?
I can't quite believe it's my 10th book either. This book, in the end, it came about very, very quickly in terms of the writing, but I actually started it without knowing what it was going to be back in 2010 when I was a postdoc for a year at the Department of History of Science at Harvard. And I took the opportunity to go every day to the Countway medical library, and was essentially rifling my way through the Walter Cannon papers, knowing that if I wasn't going to be at Harvard, I would never really get access to these things again, not easily. And so then I had this body of sources that have been underused, I would say, and I wasn't sure what I was going to do with them. And it took a very long time, over 10 years, sort of finding my way in the history of emotions and now the history of experience to have an understanding of how to marshal this material and what else I needed to go with it. So that was the beginning point was a long time ago, but then when I realized what to do with it, I had to go all over the place, a long time in New York at the Rockefeller Archive Center, and also in London at the Wellcome, and quite a lot of work also in Berlin. So it took a little while to gather all of the the sources. But then the book was essentially written in lockdown in March, April, and May last year.
Wow. So that's incredible. 3 months. I want to ask you a little bit about history of the emotions and the history of experience and what it's like to sort of do work in that vein. In Humane Professions, and I'm going to read this quote. You say it is, quote, about the strategy and tactics developed for an internationally networked defense of experimental medicine. And in some respects, it's about the formation of a public relations strategy by the medical establishment, but that your analysis goes beyond the political and rhetorical to the experiential. So can you say a little bit more about how you do this? How do you go beyond the political and rhetorical to the experiential with the records you're working with?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and experience is at the heart of this book, and it's something that I've been working towards for quite a few years, trying to make sense of what the history of emotions was good for and where its limits were and how to transcend those limits. And kept coming back to this question of experience, which seemed to go beyond emotions, but to also to include the configuration of emotions with senses and with knowledge and with practices and with representation, and to sort of capture, if you like, how it felt to be there then, but beyond a sort of reductive category like emotion. And fortunately, in this for this context. For this subject matter, experience was also at the heart of what they were talking about. So if you like, it gave me a double level. I wanted to try to get at what late 19th century scientists were talking about when they were talking about experience, and also to do it through this historiographical analytical lens. And for these scientists, experience was everything, insofar as they had announced, and they announced repeatedly, that they'd sort of reached the end of book learning, and if you wanted to know things in the culture of 19th century research, then you had to do these things. Reading about them wasn't good enough, and so they connected their expertise to the experience of being in the laboratory, and that then implicates experimentation. So you have these three words: experience, experiment, and expertise, which are etymologically connected, but they're at the heart of what this book is about. And this, to get at it, I spend a long time looking at what these scientists say, but I also spend a lot of time looking at what they do, what life is like in the laboratory, and the way in which the claims they make, the professions they make about their experiences in the laboratory, feed back into the practices of the laboratory. So I'm really looking at this dynamic relationship of saying and doing, trying to drill down to what it felt like to be an experimental medical researcher in this period. And sometimes they give you these great insights about how they felt when they were doing certain things, and these feelings are often at odds with what you would expect. And, you know, in a context where you're talking about vivisecting animals, they often talk about the banality of work. And occasionally they talk about, you know, the satisfaction of doing something that's so socially beneficent. And what's key, what's missing is any sense of horror, any sense of disgust or reticence, but rather a kind of a drive to keep doing this thing because of its ultimate good.
And is there anything, just, I'm going to ask a very simple question. Is there anything about life as a medical scientist in the late 19th or early 20th century that our listeners would need to know about, and just in terms of how it's different from life today, before we really start digging into the substance of your argument?
Mm. Yeah, well, a lot of things, I guess. The key thing, I mean, I start this story with the British example in the 1870s. And it's a moment at which professional and specialist scientists are sort of emerging, and they're existing in tandem with these older, more sort of gentlemen generalists who dabble in a bit of everything. And for a while, there's this mixture of, shall we say, sort of old school amateur generalism that tends to face outwards, you know, has a kind of public presence, and this young gun specialist working for a living, whose focus is what goes on inside the laboratory and only that. And that generates a tension, which I think is very specific to this time. The other thing that I think's important to say is that in this book, I'm talking about the ways in which the medical profession came together, organized itself, formalized its self-defense, if you like. And that's a lot to do with international network building and learning how to exercise a kind of institutional or establishment power out of necessity, where before there wasn't necessarily this kind of coherent way of defending an entire profession.
So what's really interesting about this is that, as a perspective, you say it, the perspective of these are really the powerful people, or the sort of medical profession emerging as legitimate and prestigious. And their arguments are put in contrast to the anti-vivisectionists, who mm-hmm. you write, there's actually been a lot more written about the anti-vivisectionists. So, yeah. And kind of this counterintuitive way, the argument that is made by the powerful people is the one that's gotten less attention in the literature up until now.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what anti-vivisectionists believe and how that contrasts with the defense of experimental medicine?
Yeah. So one of the things that I noticed a long time ago was that there wasn't much written about the medical scientists. And when people did write about them, there was a kind of a fairly common assumption that they were in some ways split personalities. Like they were upstanding gentlemen, if you like, in their everyday lives, but then somehow became these monstrous practitioners in the laboratory. And I felt that was simply taking late 19th century anti-vivisectionist rhetoric at its word. And, you know, that inspired me to actually make the inquiry. But the reality is there is so much more about anti-vivisectionism. And that's in part because of its connection to socially progressive movements, to first wave feminism, and to also a kind of social history angle that from in the 1960s and 70s especially was trying to recover something, and you know, it coincided with the post-Second World War animal rights movement, and that gave anti-vivisectionism a kind of a purchase in the historiography that I think elevated it in some ways beyond its importance. Reading that anti-vivisectionist stuff from the 19th century, what's most striking about most of it is that its most fundamental concern is not something like animal rights, animal welfare figures, but their main concern is something to do with morality in a civilized state, and the threat, as it's seen within anti-vivisectionist literature, is that the leaders of civilization are going to be displaced by these scientific minds, the leaders being the clergy and you know, the kind of grounding of morals in religion, to be replaced by this kind of rather callous intellectual curiosity. And that's the signal note of anti-vivisectionism. And once I kind of tapped that, the response of the scientists made much more sense.
So can you tell us a little bit about the response of the scientists, and how do anti-vivisectionists kind of inspire what becomes a really coordinated movement among the scientific and medical communities?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the anti-vivisectionist movement gains ground very quickly in Britain, and there's an attempt made by anti-vivisectionists to try to legislate for animal cruelty in the laboratory, and the response, and this seems very typically English, the response of the scientific community is to match that legislative attempt with their own attempt to regulate themselves, and this was really led by people like Charles Darwin, who, and you know, classic case of a you know, the sort of amateur generalist, you know, not a practicing physiologist, no real laboratory experience at all, and yet he felt this need to protect his scientific colleagues by putting forward his own version of what amounts to a regulative piece of legislation. And neither of these things worked, actually, and it led to a royal commission of inquiry about vivisection and the effect it had on the scientists who did it, and, you know, whether there was a kind of callousness at the head of society. And in the end, there was an act of legislation which I think pleased neither side in particular, but it did at least provide a legal framework for anti-vivisectionists to try to prosecute scientists whose curiosity had got the better of them. Unfortunately, they sort of overshot. They tried to prosecute David Ferrier for practicing without a license, doing experiments on monkeys, and it garnered a lot of attention, but it also rallied the scientific community. I mean, Ferrier, the case was thrown out, and all the charges were dropped, but it did lead to a kind of collection of monies among the scientific community, which ended up funding the Association for the advancement of medicine by research, which was began in 1882, I think. And it was this group of medical scientists, comprised basically of all the people who were doing the chief work in experimental medicine, who ended up with de facto control over the government issuing of licenses to do the research. It was an entirely corrupt arrangement, but it seemed to be to the satisfaction of both the Home Office and the scientists that they would basically vet all the applications for experimental licenses and advise the government to issue them. And that wasn't widely known. Mm-hmm. And it basically wrong-footed the anti-vivisection movement for a generation in Britain, because the scientists had effectively complete control over the process. And it was, I make a point of this in the book, it was actually, I see it as a way of Darwin apologizing for his earlier meddling, that he gifted this association £100 as part of its getting off the ground. And that was one of the last acts he made before his death.
So the defense of experimental medicine gets started in Britain. Mm-hmm. But then the story sort of travels, and you move to Germany and Massachusetts. You tell us a little bit about how the argument sort of changed shape when they moved to different locations.
Yeah. It's easy to track the way in which anti-vivisectionism was networked. There are certain key figures that appear in all of these locations, or if they don't appear directly, you can connect people directly. And so anti-vivisectionism in Germany kind of comes pre-packaged from England, but it's met with a completely different kind of scientific and professional and also social response, in part because Germany is the critical center of innovation in this kind of medical research. It's where all the scientists from all over the place went to get trained. Part of the reason it's so well-developed and it's so esteemed is that these German scientists are already, they're professionals, they're government employees. What they do in the laboratory is done with the sanction of the state, which is very different to the case either in Britain or in the US. And the anti-vivisection movement, I mean, it has some, I guess you could call them flashpoints of success in Germany, but it quickly gets absorbed into rather more radical configurations to do with, you know, a kind of nature holism or vegetarianism, such that it doesn't really have this broad appeal. The scientists essentially, whilst they organize themselves to a certain extent, their main response is just ignore this and it will go away. The main thing with the Germans is that in both Britain and in the US, there's this rhetorical line that somehow there's something about experimental medicine which is German, but in a bad way. There's something in these practices which indicates a kind of callousness or a kind of a lack of sensitivity, which is peculiar to German science. And the fear is that this is being taught and then appropriated by scientists from other countries. And the vivisection, anti-vivisectionists make a lot of that, but there's also, you can see scientists in Britain and in the US trying to reassure both themselves and the public that no, they're just teaching us what to do. We're not taking any kind of any German kind of character flaws with us. But it's interesting that that's there and it endures.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I wonder if this might be a good place to just kind of say a few words about what exactly experimental medicine was. What methods were they using? This is not we don't mean experiments on human subjects, right?
Generally, no. Although the question of human experimentation becomes it looms ever larger the further along you go. And certainly in the anti-vivisectionist rhetoric, there's always this perceived threat that the scientists' curiosity will get the better of them and they will divert their attention to the use of living humans in the laboratory. But in the main, no, the question is about experimentation on living animals. And there are a number of different disciplinary specialisms which are developing in this period. Physiology is the main one. Mm-hmm. Branches like toxicology, immunology, bacteriology, they're all using animals in some way. I mean, this is the era of making sort of serum and experimenting with vaccines. And, you know, if you want to make diphtheria serum, say, or something for meningitis, then you need a lot of animals in order to kind of culture the thing. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of a broad definition of experimental. Sometimes animals are simply instrumental. But all of these different branches of medical science are using live animals in some way. And a great amount of the attention revolves around the extent to which the animals are conscious of what's happening to them. And so a lot of focus is on the status of anesthesia and the extent to which you can have a living animal which is nonetheless completely unconscious.
Right. So thank you for clarifying that. Let's kind of jump to the United States now and, mm-hmm. and talk a little bit about how anti-vivisection bills fared in Massachusetts at the turn of the 20th century. So what was it like here in the United States?
Well, so the anti-vivisection movement gets to the U.S. later than in Britain or Germany. And in part, that's because the development of experimental laboratories in the US is itself also a little bit later. But the people who are, you know, at the center of that development are aware from the start that there is likely to be at some point an attempt either to shut down experimentation involving animals or to legislate against it. And this is part of the networking that I'm tracking, that there are key figures in the US who are very well plugged in to what's happening in Germany and what's happening in Britain. And so when it eventually comes about in Massachusetts and then later in New York, these budding anti-vivisectionist societies start putting forward attempts in state legislatures to either regulate or abolish vivisection. And the community, really only kind of loosely affiliated community of medical scientists in those states, realize they have to come together, and you see a kind of correspondence network. In the first instance, it's led by people like Bowditch at Harvard, just writing to everyone they know around who has something to do with this, to get them to submit their experiences with working with animals and to basically attest to their sound ethical principles. In the absence of any kind of formalized modes of procedure or ethical guidelines. And each year there's an attempt to legislate, and each year they come together and they submit their remonstrances, and the next year it repeats and it repeats and it repeats until the medical scientists get absolutely sick of having to turn out year on year and do the same thing. And the bills never go anywhere. They're always thrown out. But the concern grows that, well, you know, this is turning into a sort of war of attrition. If we get so sick and tired of it that we take our eye off the ball, then the anti-vivisectionists will sort of sneak something through and we'll pay for it forever. And so these early experiences with dealing with bills before state legislatures lead to this more formal organization of a defense.
I took this section to also be pointing towards a kind of tension between, you know, knowledge about what goes on in the laboratory being accessible only to a privileged elite or being secret, or and knowledge about what goes on in the laboratory being more public or transparent.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that tension?
Yeah, that's a very central tension in the whole book, because on the one hand, the key scientists always are pains to say that our laboratories are open. Anyone that wants to come and look only has to ask. We will show you around. We will show you what we do. We've got nothing to hide. You know, no one needs to say anything about, you know, shining light in dark places, because, you know, it's all very transparent. At the same time, at the core of their defensive argument is you can't possibly understand what's going on in these laboratories unless you're working in one. The knowledge that's produced in these places is absolutely tied to the experience of producing it. And therefore, anyone from the outside, any layperson that comes in, they might look at it and make entirely the wrong conclusion because they don't have what they need to understand it. And this, I mean, in a way, this puts the scientists in this quite precarious position of having to say what we're doing is for the overwhelming good of society, but you have to take our word for it. Because only if you're a scientist can you understand that that's true. And I think that that's the fundamental instability of what they're trying to do.
And that the claim that only they have access to a particular type of experience, right?
Yeah, that's it. Because I mean, they run into this problem quite a lot where they, you know, published accounts of what's been done in the laboratory get picked up by anti-vivisectionists. And parts of sort of descriptions of experiments are amplified as if this is proof of some kind of horrible cruelty. And the response is, no, you just simply don't understand. Unless you've done this experiment, you don't understand how the anesthetic works. You don't understand how the procedure works. You don't understand the nature of the animal's condition, anything. It makes for a kind of zero-sum game in a way. Like there isn't a coherent argument between two sides. There are simply two sides. And whenever the medical scientists are attacked, their defense is not in terms of what was charged against them, but simply a dismissal of those charges on the basis of, you don't have access to understanding this, so everything you say is nonsense.
So this defense of experimental medicine, this takes place in the courts to a certain extent, but it also generates a really robust kind of public debate in popular periodicals and different organizations that are sort of lobbying for their point of view. Could you tell us a little bit about the Research Defense Society, which, well, I mean, the name is, it's quite clear what they intend to do. But how did they sort of marshal the defense of experimental medicine?
Okay, so this is where the British and the American stories diverge in quite an interesting way. So the Research Defense Society is the British based society, and it replaces the Association for the Advancement of Medicine by Research, although it takes a lot of its personnel with it. But the idea of it was to, if you like, end this constant non-debate between anti-vivisection activists on the one hand and scientists on the other hand, and instead try to build a community of lay support, but lay support in a very particular way, comprised of society figures, eminent ladies, the clergy, the aristocracy, essentially people who they thought, you know, their word would, or their name alone, irrespective of what they said, would carry this great weight of influence and change the reception of vivisection at a societal level. And so this is really a conscious attempt to build a kind of public-facing organization for the defense of research, where the mouthpieces weren't themselves scientists.
And were they successful?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult to actually to measure in concrete terms how successful they were. All I can do really is go on the context in which this society is exerting its influence. And what you see is a greater and greater expansion of medical experimentation with greater and greater support from governments and the crown against a kind of dwindling effectiveness in among anti-vivisectionists. And so, you know, I mean, the society itself, they got thousands of members, you know, all paying. You know, a lot of people prepared to to publicly state that animal experimentation is done for the overwhelming good of society. And you have to say, at least, you know, into the period of the First World War and after, that if there's a kind of a victorious half here, it's definitely not the anti-vivisectionists. It's medical research.
You have a really compelling quote that I'm just going to read out here, that medical experimentation as a humane profession becomes a government business.
Yeah.
Could you say a little bit more about how that happens?
Yeah. So it's through a number of threads that slowly come together. This is in the UK. So there's, you know, the AAMR has been behind the scenes pulling the strings of the way that government licensing works. And eventually, through a second Royal Commission into vivisection, everyone realizes that they can't sustain this obvious conflict of interest. But in the meantime, the government itself appointed another Royal Commission to look into tuberculosis. And I mean, the standard way of conducting a Royal Commission is you have a bunch of men who sit at a desk and they get lots of people to come in and talk to them and give them testimony. And when they formed the Royal Commission for Tuberculosis, the commissioners realized that the only way to do it was to do research. And so they spent a long time, like years, doing experimental research on tuberculosis paid for by the Crown. And I think that established a principle of the potential benefit of doing this kind of research, you know, for kind of public good. Then in the process of putting together the National Insurance Act, there was a clause in the act which apportioned some of the monies that would be coming in for national insurance to medical research. And what was amazing about that clause is no one's quite sure who put it there in the act. And it received very little debate in what were otherwise extremely extensive debates about National Insurance Act. When the act passed, that meant in 1911 that there was going to be £57,000 a year for medical research, which hadn't existed hitherto. And in order to spend it, to work out how to organize it, the medical research committee was formed, which started basically to spend this public money on experimental research. And it happened sort of amazingly, you know, without anti-vivisectionists even seeming to notice that there was this massively important turning of the tide, where suddenly the Crown would be the main sponsor of this kind of research in the name of public health. So after 1911, you know, the anti-vivisectionists are still there and they're still campaigning, but the government has agreed, you know, in principle and in law, to funding this kind of research indefinitely.
So before we get to World War One, I want to ask a question about the images that you use. I don't want to miss the chance to do that. You use several satirical images from the magazine Puck, and yeah. I wondered if you would care to describe one of them and maybe talk a little bit about how the satire relates to sort of larger debates around experimental medicine.
Yeah, so I mean, I love these Puck images because they're so vivid. Unfortunately, in the book, they're black and white, but they're the original is incredibly colorful, popping images. Essentially, this is the key difference about the American story, is that they absolutely did not, the medical establishment did not look for the support of eminent society figures. They directly went to the popular press and looked for journalists and editors who would write essentially for them. And Puck magazine was one of these sort of muckraking popular magazines that was on the side of the medical establishment. And so these images from Puck are essentially their attempts to encapsulate the argument of medical science and to ridicule these high society anti-vivisectionists. So that the image that I opened the book with is of an urban conflagration. There's a big fire, and the fire itself is a metaphor for disease. You can see disease written in the plumes of smoke that are coming out of the building, as the poor trapped in the building try and jump, and the only thing saving them is this life net, which is being held by firemen. Now, the firemen all have white beards, and white beard meant physiologist. In this period, there's a physiologist look, and it's these firemen holding this life net, which says on it, vivisectional research life net, while another one holds a hose, and the water that sprays on the fire is called knowledge. And meanwhile, all around them, you see these sort of society cranks trying to chop the hose with an axe, mm-hmm. or to strangle the firemen or to pull them away. And, you know, the classic representation of the anti-vivisectionist lady is someone who has a lap dog and a bonnet with birds of paradise plumes in it, sort of in order to kind of mock their hypocrisy, like they can't possibly really be caring about animals. And yet, as they try to stop this research happening, they're actually allowing the poor to fall to their deaths. So it's, you know, and there's a whole series of these, and they perfectly encapsulate what the scientists were themselves trying to say or trying to get journalists to write on their behalf.
But so in the US, it's a little bit more populist, would you say, the defense, and a little less elitist?
Well, I think it's elitist, but in a different way. Mm-hmm. So the American medical scientists had a higher opinion of themselves. They would say to each other, the medical establishment is much more influential and respected here than it is in Britain, where it's all still, you know, clergymen and aristocrats. So in a way, they took their professional status to be more important. But they also took seriously this argument they made that if you weren't a scientist, you couldn't understand, and therefore took responsibility themselves for putting out the argument about why vivisection was good, instead of sort of passing it off to a social elite, let's say. And that meant that they, you know, they worked hand in hand with journalists, feeding them information, writing them bits, and making sure that you know, their arguments would appear prominently in places like Harper's Weekly, mm-hmm. where society readers would get the right opinion, if you see what I mean.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about the legacy of these debates, because certainly we, you know, now there is government funded research and experimental medical research that uses animals and things like that. What happens to the defense of experimental medicine after World War One, and then how does the story told in this book continue to influence debates about medical ethics?
Well, I mean, I see in many ways, I see the war as a kind of fracture point, but for complicated reasons. So I think by the end of the war, or maybe even by the start of the war, the argument that comes from the medical establishment is really well set. And it's maintained after the war. But the context of medical research after the war changes quite dramatically, especially as governments start to do medical research in a military capacity. So government's much more interested in medical research, but also it's much more interested in secrecy. And that alters the kind of position of medical science, which had always argued that it was public and open and there for all to see. And after the First World War, that is much less true. It's much more secretive. Second thing is, I close the book with this, that all of these, or the vast majority of these scientists, had been arguing from the perspective of laboratory experimentation using animals. And suddenly they're confronted with this growth of clinical experimentation using humans who may not have been able to fully consent to what was happening to them in clinical research. And so you get throughout the period of my study, but especially towards the end of it, the question of informed consent starts to really come to the fore. And it's not dealt with very well at that point, but that would become the dominant 20th century question, the ethical question of who can consent and how can we make sure this consent is fully informed consent. So that's another another major change, actually, that signifies the war as a kind of fracture point in this story. Some things stay the same. The question of the status of suffering, whether an animal suffers to the same extent as a human, and how you measure the difference, or in some way accord a different ethical status to different kinds of being. That question never went away, became much more acute and much more deeply researched in the 20th century. And with it, this calculus of suffering measured against a calculus of benefit. And so that very much is alive in the period that I study here. In the 20th century, I think with the diversification of research using animals, some of which is for medicine and some of which is really not, and you know, the whole use of cosmetics and so on, this question of benefit against suffering or benefit against risk becomes much more sharply focused in the 20th century, but you see its roots here.
But I think that the book makes the point that this is not a sort of utilitarian calculus the whole way through.
Right, that's true. It's not, and in a way, it becomes more so. In some quarters, I tried to make the point that medical scientists weren't necessarily, on the whole, utilitarian. They were their sort of ethical bearing came from Darwin, from the descent of man, and they were able to envision this sort of far-seeing good. But having said that, when they were envisioning this far-seeing good, they did tend to weigh it against, there's one sort of famous equation, about the life of one human against 1,000 guinea pigs. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing made it into it. But, most of my study is about it's about a kind of humanity, and it's about a kind of beneficence, and it's about progress, and it's about the value of curiosity. That calculus of suffering is there, and it's ready to be exploited at various points. And if you read Kathy Gear's book on pain, pleasure, and the greater good, it's clear that in the 20th century, this calculus of suffering is still very much alive in the social cultural discussion of what experimenters are doing.
Yes, I have read that book, and it's almost like a sequel to this one.
That too.
We could keep going, but we have taken up a lot of your time already, Rob, and so I am going to go ahead with our traditional final question, okay, which is, what are you working on next? Is there an 11th book?
Well, 11, 12, 13 are already on the way. There's a lot going on. The next sort of single authored research book, I'm working on a book for Polity called Knowing Pain, which is a history of sensation, emotion, and experience. Really covers a history of pain from antiquity to the present and globally, which one of these things that I do as self-punishment every now and again. But I'm also working right now I'm finishing up an edited book with Bettina Hitzer called Feeling Disease, which is about the experience of medicine and illness in modern history. And that's a really exciting collection of essays, which we had this conference right before, it was in January 2020, so right before the pandemic really hit us. And suddenly the questions we were asking at that conference became very urgent. So that's going to be out next year.
Well, those sound like many exciting projects in the pipeline. Rob, thank you so much for taking the time to share your work with us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.